Welcome to Haunted Road, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. Listener discretion is advised.
You might say that Birmingham, Alabama was fated to become a center of industry, a place made rich by manufacturing products and shipping them across the globe. But all of that prosperity came at a cost, a human cost. Birmingham quickly became a center of iron production, but smelting all that iron ore was a laborious job that was deathly dangerous. Men sustained terrible injuries and were sometimes cooked alive from exposure to the molten iron. And as racial inequity and hostility toward Black Americans grew, the burden those men bore became disproportionately more perilous. The slos furnaces contain the ghosts of some of the darkest moments in Birmingham's history, and it's all still there today, being relived by those who won't or can't leave it behind. I'm Amy Bruni, and this is Haunted Road. When Birmingham was founded in 1871, its planners envisioned a rich future. In an Appalachian valley in north-central Alabama, the city sat at the crossroads of two railroad lines on one of the world's richest mineral deposits. Hopes to establish a town with considerable industry were so high that investors in the Ellerton Land Company, the founding company of the city, named it after Birmingham, England, the epicenter of the iron industry in the UK. The plan worked, thanks in large part to slos furnaces, a processing plant that extracted iron from rocks by superheating the iron ore, converting it into liquid iron, and cooling it into a solid that was then sold and used for countless purposes. Slos Furnaces was built in 1881, named after Colonel James Withers Slos, one of Birmingham's founding fathers. Slos played an important role in the founding of the city because he convinced a major railroad of the day to lay tracks through the fledgling town. In its first year, Slos Furnaces sold 24,000 tons of iron. Along with other manufacturing plants, Slos became so profitable so rapidly that Birmingham became known as Magic City, a nickname that came from the fact that the city grew so quickly it seemed to be by magic. By the mid-1880s, Birmingham was a bona fide manufacturing hub. Demand grew so quickly that its owners began construction on a second furnace just a year after its opening. Combined, the furnaces could produce over 250 tons of iron a day. Slos Furnaces National Historic Landmark describes the physical structure. 60 feet high and 18 feet in diameter, Slos's new Whitwell stoves were the first of their type ever built in Birmingham and were comparable to similar equipment used in the North. Local observers were proud that much of the machinery used by Slos's new furnaces would be of Southern manufacture. It included two blowing engines and 10 boilers, 30 feet long and 46 inches in diameter. According to the podcast Homespun Haunts, pig iron, the main product of the furnaces, gets its name from the shape of the cooling trenches the workers would dump the molten iron in to cool. These trenches looked like a sow feeding piglets. In 1883, Slos Furnaces won a bronze medal for the best pig iron at the Louisville Exhibition. Iron was extracted in the two furnaces through a hot, dangerous process. As the Slos Furnaces tour describes, iron ore, limestone, coke, and hot air were continuously fed into the furnace, which would reach temperatures of 3,800 degrees. As the materials moved down and hot air moved up in the furnace, two products accumulated in the bottom, or hearth: molten iron and slag. The iron and slag were withdrawn, or tapped, through two holes called notches. About every 4 hours, the iron notch, located at the base of the furnace, was opened, allowing the molten iron to flow out of the furnace. In addition to the furnaces themselves, the plant contained many more buildings, including 10 boilers that would burn waste gas created inside the furnace during the iron-making process, and a pyrometer house, which contained the machines that measured temperature in the furnaces. According to the Slos Furnaces tour, this building is the strongest built building on the site and would be used to protect the workers if anything went seriously wrong with the furnace. This use of the pyrometer house prompted the workers to call it the doghouse, saying the furnace would get mad at them and put them in the doghouse. Those furnaces were powered by blowing engines. As the tour describes, the blowing engines stand over 30 feet tall and turn flywheels 20 feet in diameter at a rate of about 30 revolutions per minute. Each engine had a steam cylinder on the bottom and an air cylinder on the top. Steam drove the piston in the steam cylinder up and down, in turn driving the piston in the air cylinder. The moving piston pulled in air, compressed it, and pushed it out. These generated a large amount of noise. The decibel level would compare to that of standing front row at a rock concert. Cast sheds cover the areas where iron was poured from the furnaces and then cooled into pigs. According to industrial archaeology, the work of breaking and carrying the newly cast pigs was arduous, hot, and dangerous. Workers wore wooden shoes in order to protect their feet from being scorched by the liquid iron and had to work at a rapid pace to clear the shed for the next opening of a furnace notch. The furnaces didn't just generate significant income for Birmingham. Visiting them was a pastime for locals. The road to the plant has significant shoulders so that people could gather and watch the plant's workings at a safe distance. As Robin McDonald wrote in the Anniston Star, people gathered in the smoke, the fumes, and the steam each night along the viaduct to watch molten iron and burning slag pour from the nearby furnace mouths. Some brought their dates, some brought their children, some came on Sunday afternoon furnace party picnics. Other southern cities had undeniable segregation problems and racial tensions, but Birmingham had especially severe and distinct racial division. Martin Luther King Jr. once described Birmingham as the most segregated city in America. By the mid-20th century, Birmingham became notorious for its segregation. This included a series of racially motivated bombings, most famously the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, which killed four young black girls. Earlier that year, during the Birmingham campaign, a massive desegregation action, the city's public safety commissioner, Eugene Bull Connor, oversaw the use of extreme force against nonviolent protesters, generating worldwide outrage. These protests were when Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested and wrote his famous letter from Birmingham jail. The manufacturing industry, including Sloss furnaces, was highly segregated until the 1960s. Workers at Sloss were required to keep everything separate. They bathed in separate bathhouses, punched separate time clocks, and stayed in separate company housing. As Karen Utz wrote in the Alabama Humanities Alliance, between 1900 and 1950, Sloss furnaces maintained company houses throughout Birmingham's industrial district. Sloss quarters, the 48 houses adjacent to city furnaces, were designed specifically for African American workers. They were typical shotgun-style structures with two rooms set on foundation posts and no indoor plumbing until the 1930s. While not a company town in the strictest sense, the quarters contained a doctor's office, a commissary, and offered numerous neighborhood gatherings, including watermelon cuttings, suppers, dancing, and ball games. By the turn of the century, Birmingham's iron and steel workforce was 65% black, a number that would climb to 75% by 1910. Black employees were only offered the most perilous jobs in a very dangerous industry. Whites populated all the managerial and scientific roles at the furnaces, while black workers were relegated to lower-paying, riskier roles. There were various ways to die in the furnaces, including being crushed by an elevator full of ore, like William Mitchell in 1889, overcome by gas, like Julian Wood in 1891, buried in coal from a coal chute, like Leviticus Spann in 1892, hit in the head with a bucket of bricks like Will Buchanan in 1897, or simply being found dead on coke oven like David Tuck in 1899. In November 1882, less than a year after it opened, a horrific accident took place at Sloss Furnaces. Two black workers, Alec King and Bob Mayfield, had been lowered into one of the furnace's stacks in order to clean off a scaffold, a buildup of coke and ore that caused it to malfunction. When the scaffold gave way, it sent up a pillar of smoke and ash, suffocating the men and causing them to fall into the fire of the furnace. One local newspaper, whose reporter was on scene as their bodies were recovered, described a truly nightmarish sight in an article headlined, "Another Furnace Horror." The reporter wrote, "After removing a quantity of slag and ore, they drew out the charred and blackened remains of what had been, only a few moments before, two living beings. The bodies were a ghastly and revolting sight. The skulls were bleached white, the arms of both were drawn up above the heads, the fingers were clenched tight, and only small particles of charred flesh remained on blackened bones. It was a scene that was indescribably horrible." The article ran directly next to a report of a man's suicide by jumping into nearby Alice Furnace. In February 1892, an accident notable enough to make the New York Times took place at Sloss Furnaces. A scaffold collapse caused eight men to fall 58 feet. Two, John Stanton and Jake Ritchie, both white mechanics in their early 20s, were killed instantly. A contemporary report in the Daily Advertiser described Ritchie's head as being mashed into a jelly. The other six men, who were both white and black, were all injured, five severely. Their injuries ranged from broken limbs and jawbones to burns and internal injuries. In August 1897, the Times reported on another death at Sloss, this one more mysterious. Joseph F. Webb, a painter for the Southern Railway, was found dead in a tank of boiling water at Sloss. His body was discovered by a 12-year-old boy who worked at the furnaces as a coke puller. As the Times described it, the body was cooked and the flesh fell off in chunks as it was drawn from the vat. Webb had last been seen leaving a bar the night before, and his friends suspected he was murdered and his body thrown into the tank. When his body was pulled from the tank, bruises were visible around his neck. Webb was a vocal member of a white supremacist order called Regents of the White Shield, and one newspaper suggested that he had been murdered by a group of black men. However, witnesses said that he was extremely intoxicated on the night of his death, lending credence to the idea that he fell in the vat accidentally. This was the theory eventually settled on by investigators. In August 1900, five workers, all black men, were severely burned in another horrific accident at Sloss. Limestone and ore lining the walls of furnace number one fell on them as they were tending the fire, causing a terrific explosion of gas and steam, as the Birmingham Age Herald wrote. Two of the men would die from their injuries in the following days. The flippant description in the local newspaper indicates the pervasive attitude toward black people at the time. The article read, "Everything was done to alleviate the suffering of the men, but as the hospitals were all crowded, they had to be sent to their homes in various parts of the city. The furnace was in no way damaged, and the only inconvenience experienced by the company was the removal of the fallen rock. Imagine having burns so severe they would eventually take your life and being told that there was no room for you at the only place that could help you." By the 1910s, Sloss was one of the world's largest pig iron manufacturers, but owners were slow to update the furnaces with more modern systems. According to the furnace's history, between 1927 and 1931, the plant underwent a concentrated program of mechanization. Most of its major operation equipment, the blast furnaces and the charging and casting machinery, was replaced at this time. In 1927 to 1928, the two furnaces were rebuilt, enlarged, and refitted with mechanical charging equipment, doubling the plant's production capacity. The mechanization brought the plant up to date with technology that had been invented several decades earlier, and finally did away with the now antiquated sand casting method of creating pig iron. It has been suggested by historians that Sloss was so slow to keep up with the times due to the cheapness and abundance of black labor in the South. Until 1928, the furnace's coal mines were staffed with largely black convict labor. David Lewis wrote in Sloss Furnaces and the Rise of the Birmingham District, an industrial epic, that in 1890, 90 of the 1,000 inmates working there died on the job, a disproportionately high number of workplace deaths compared to similar mines. According to Stan Deal of AL.com, historians have said nobody knows how many men died at Sloss over its nine-decade history. In general, human life was considered cheap at Sloss, according to tour guide Richard Neely. As Ellen Brown wrote in The Haunting of Alabama, Dr. Neely suggested that Sloss Furnaces was not over-concerned with the welfare of the workers because they could be easily replaced. One of the workers interviewed loved to tell the story that they told the workers here. Don't kill any mules. Mules cost $25. But men? Men we can replace. In 1952, the furnaces were purchased by the U.S. Pipe and Foundry Company. In the late 1950s, the Sloss quarters were dismantled as they became too expensive for the company to maintain. The furnaces closed for good in 1971 due to stricter air pollution regulations of the Clean Air Act and old machinery that couldn't meet them. At this time, the structures were donated to the Alabama State Fair Commission. The structure was declared a National Historic Landmark in 1981. Sloss Furnaces became a museum in 1983. In addition to offering self-guided tours, the museum hosts programs like conferences, metal art exhibitions, concerts, and festivals. According to the furnace's history, Sloss is currently the only 20th century blast furnace in the U.S. being preserved and interpreted as a historic industrial site. Maybe it's because so many people were treated as less than at Sloss Furnaces that there's such strong paranormal energy at the site. Or maybe it's that more than 90 years of employees going to work every day fearing terrible injuries and possible death left a psychic stain on the place. Whatever reason there is for all of the paranormal activity, it's a lot, and it started decades ago. While Sloss was still operating, according to Stan Deal, workers in the blowing engine building reported that objects mysteriously moved. They might leave a tool in one place, for example, and come back to find it in another. That building, the oldest still standing at Sloss, is also said to be the most haunted. Full-body apparitions have been reported at Sloss Furnaces, and some people claim that they have been pushed or shoved by unseen forces. Others report hearing mysterious music they describe as an eerie singing in the complex. As Alan Brown wrote in The Spirits of Sloss Furnaces, investigators have captured EVPs on the property, including the voice of a little girl who said, "Hi, Daddy, here's your lunch." This was thought to be the spirit of one of the children who lived in Sloss Quarters. Mitch Goth in Haunted U.S. reported that people claim to have heard the voices of former workers in the facilities, telling them to mind the heat or push some steel. Sloss, though, never produced steel. The primary ghost story at Sloss Furnaces concerns an unethical foreman named James Slag Wormwood. According to legend, he ran the furnace's graveyard shift in the early 1900s. According to Fright Furnace, the Halloween event that ran at Sloss from 1997 to 2019, Slag would make his workers take dangerous risks, forcing them to speed up production. Dozens of workers are said to have died as a result of Slag's policies. The story goes that in October 1906, Slag fell from the top of a blast furnace into a pool of iron ore, dying instantly. Many assumed this was no accident, but his maltreated workers finally taking their revenge. Workers soon began to report unusual occurrences in the furnaces that they attributed to Slag's vengeful spirit. In 1971, the night before the plant closed, night watchman Samuel Blumenthal supposedly encountered the most frightening thing he had ever seen. According to Fright Furnace, he described it simply as evil, a half-man, half-demon who tried to push him up the stairs. When Blumenthal refused, the monster began to beat on him with his fists. According to legend, Blumenthal emerged from the furnaces covered in burns and later died from his injuries. However, that story and the story of Slag Wormwood is just that, a story. A story invented by the haunted attraction for the haunted attraction, which many such attractions do. However, sometimes these stories go on to be passed along as fact. According to Sloss Furnace's marketing officer, Rachel Vershore, Slag simply never existed. Vershore told Roadside America that a well-known paranormal show came down and talked to our Halloween Fright Furnace crew. They told them about Slag, a legend that they had created, and I guess the show just assumed it was real. While Sloss claims that the Halloween event invented Slag, his legend might be based in part on the true story of Theophilus Jowers, who died in Birmingham's nearby Ellis Furnace in September 1887. Many modern reports about incidents at Sloss seem to conflate Sloss and Ellis Furnaces, which were two separate companies located across town from each other. An assistant foundryman, Jowers, was assisting in switching out bells in Ellis Furnace No. 1. As he held on to a rope attached to the old bell, Jowers tripped, and he and the bell tumbled into the heat of the furnace. Catherine Wyndham wrote in The Ghost in the Sloss Furnace that, according to one contemporary news report, the intense heat reduced his body almost to ashes. A piece of sheet iron was attached to a length of gas pipe, and with that instrument, his head, bowels, two hip bones, and a few ashes were fished out. Two workmen who were on the bridge with him came very near going in as well. Some believe that Jowers' ghost haunts Sloss, the logic being that he migrated there after Ellis Furnaces closed down in 1927. It's claimed that he's been seen walking the catwalk in the furnaces. He's also been seen performing his work tasks as he would have in life, albeit not at Sloss. It's said that in 1927, his son, John Jowers, saw a figure of a man emerge from a cloud of sparks at Sloss, though the sparks would have been too hot for an actual human to be that close. That could very well have been the ghost of Theophilus Jowers. Psychics have reported that the ghost of Jowers does not want to move on and is happy at Sloss. Another popular, likely untrue ghost story claims that a woman who was pregnant out of wedlock threw herself into the furnaces sometime around 1900. As is typical of these stories, it's sometimes said to have taken place at Ellis rather than Sloss, or the two are conflated. It's claimed that at her memorial service, a white deer appeared, representing her spirit, and that this deer still appears when Sloss hosts events. While the ghost stories might not always correspond with history, there are surely lots of ghosts at Sloss. Noted as one of the most haunted locations, if not the most haunted location in Alabama, there are lots of stories to tell. I've investigated there, so I've got a few experiences to share, and so does paranormal investigator Kevin Walden, who we will be chatting with up next. That is coming up after the break. So I am now joined by paranormal investigator Kevin Walden, who has spent a lot of time investigating Sloss Furnaces. I've investigated there as well, so I think together we can have a great conversation. So thanks for joining us, Kevin.
That's no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
I kind of want to start off by saying that Sloss Furnaces is clearly a very historical location. They still have a lot of programs there and things, and you can visit them anytime. They have kind of backed away from their ghosts and their paranormal tours. And I do see kind of a lot of locations, not a lot, but locations do occasionally do that. Something happens, they get a bad taste in their mouth about it, or they're concerned about, you know, being disrespectful. And so I just want to send the message out to Sloss and other historical locations that are truly haunted that think that it is disrespectful to pursue that. Just know that there are very much ways to keep your history accurate and very respectfully handle your hauntings, and at the same time, bring in some extra revenue, which I know a lot of these locations need. So if any locations out there want to talk to me about it, please reach out. I love helping, and I think it is a great opportunity, but I also completely understand when places kind of veer away from it. So just know that in the right hands, you all can do it. So that being said, Kevin, Sloss is wild. I have investigated there a few times on and off camera and have had some pretty amazing experiences there. So what drew you to that haunt in the first place?
Well, you know, Sloss has just always kind of been there in the background of Birmingham. A lot of history there, a lot of tragic deaths, unfortunately. And ever since I was a child, I've always been kind of interested in, you know, the spooky stuff and the kind of scary things. But what actually got me to go there, we had to do a presentation for one of our high school classes. And they said they wanted us to go out and do something we've never done before. So me and my group, we decided, hey, let's go ghost hunting. Oddly enough, there was a ghost hunters marathon going on Sci-Fi Channel. So just sitting here talking to you about this is kind of crazy in its own right, but
it always comes around, right? Full circle.
Yeah, so we decided we were actually going to go out to Old Bryce out in Tuscaloosa. It's this old mental institution, looks straight out of a horror movie. So we pack up, we head out there. We get about four steps in the door and a state trooper shows up. You know, we were young and dumb, about 16, 17 years old, but we were detained for about 20 minutes. I think he was just trying to scare us more than anything. But finally, he let us go. We were coming back from Tuscaloosa into Birmingham, and that's when we saw it off in the distance. The Towers of Slush just standing there staring back at us. Hmm. And we were like, you know what? Let's give it another shot. Let's go here. So we pull in, and there's a security guard working. And as soon as we come walking up, he's, you know, what are you guys doing here? And we told him, man, we're just trying to do this thing for school. We're trying to get a good grade on it. He was like, well, I'll tell you what. You guys come in. I'll give you a free tour. So he walked us around, and then finally he was like, I'm going to be leaving here at about midnight. You guys got 2 hours to do your thing, and then I'm out.
Wow.
And I think he was scared to be there, really, after midnight.
That's so interesting. So you did it the right way. You actually had permission. I think that happens sometimes. You know, when I was in high school, I'm totally guilty of going places I should not have. And yeah, and now I think it's great that it's so kind of at the forefront, because we can educate kids now, like, hey, you don't have to break into these locations. There are plenty of places for you to go with permission. And so I'm glad that you guys had permission. And you know, it's probably meant to be. So now that night, what happened? Did you have any experiences?
Well, with that being our first night ghost hunting, you know, I think a lot of it was just us kind of being paranoid. And, you know, we're comparing it to, you know, movies in Hollywood and stuff like that. But that doesn't take away from some of the crazy things we did experience. That's where we learned the story of Slag.
Right, which isn't necessarily true, but but it's a good story.
At the time, it was definitely true in our minds. Yeah, we were walking around. We had this one kid in our class that we'd never really talked to, but once he found out we were ghost hunting, he was like, you know, dude, I'm all in. Let me go with you. So he's walking around, and he's got this audio recorder, and there's this big pipe next to him. He says, hey, man, if you died in this pipe, let me know. And he reaches his arm up in the pipe. Well, when he pulls the recorder back out, he rewinds it, hits play. And this voice comes through right after he puts it in the pipe, and it says, creepy. But the way it says it is also creepy, because it was like, creepy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And another thing that happened with the audio recorder, my cousin Sean had set it down. We were going to leave it in one little spot by itself for about an hour, just come back and listen to it, which, you know, as well as I do, listening back to all that audio is painstaking. But
it really is. That's why voice activated recorders are my friend now.
Yeah. But he lays the recorder down and he says, okay, we're going to leave this here for about an hour. We'll come back and get it. So we walk off and we get lost in there because Sloss is so huge and there's so many twists and turns. And when we finally find it, it was about an hour and a half later. Well, he picks the recorder up, hits stop on it. He says, and cut. We go to rewind it back, and I'm like, something's wrong with this. This file isn't too long up here. So we hit play on it. And it starts off with him saying, we're going to leave this recorder here. If anybody's here, let us know. He sets it down. You hear this loud, like, whoosh sound. And then it goes directly into him saying, and cut. So to us, it's like something came up, turned the recorder off, and when we were coming back to get it, turned it back on.
I've had that happen before, and it's interesting. It's like, yeah, we don't really want to talk to you. And I mean, at this time, they might have been having investigations, and you know, they start to get familiar with your equipment, and they're like, oh, this is that thing that hears us click. They turn it off. So not today, but yeah, I mean, I found that there, the spirits kind of are, they can either be very active or sometimes just kind of shy.
I think we investigated there a total of 7 times. And most nights we'd have something happen, something crazy would happen. I think there was only one night we went in and the ghosts were like, man, we're tired of you guys. Get out of here, you know?
Did you have any experiences in that tunnel? Because I had a wild experience in the tunnel with Meatloaf, of all people. But did you have any experiences in the tunnel?
We did have some strange things happen in there. There was one night, there was four of us. And we were walking around. We go down into the tunnel. Well, as we're walking along, we kind of split up. Two of us go one way, two of us go the other. And while we're standing there talking, all of a sudden from up above us, I hear what sounds like somebody grabbing a metal chair and just sliding it across the floor upstairs.
Mm.
So me, I instantly run towards it. I go up there, don't see anything out of the ordinary. But when I'm watching our footage back, as we're going down into the tunnel, there's two metal chairs sitting to the side of the staircase. But when we come back up, there's only one chair sitting there, and there was nobody else there but us that night.
That's wild. So that's the kind of thing when that happens, like your whole body just kind of goes, oh, okay. Yeah, you know, in that tunnel. So that was actually one of the first places that I had a really good experience with the laser grid. And so I was investigating in the tunnel with Adam Berry and Meatloaf. Meatloaf was a massive paranormal fan. And so I got to investigate with him a few times, and he just was like very gung-ho. He loved it. And so he sat in that tunnel with Adam and myself, and we had used the laser grid. We kind of aimed it all the way down the tunnel. And we watched as a shadow kept kind of peeking out. And the thing with the laser grid is when a shadow walks into it, like a shadow figure, the little points just disappear. And you see the outline of a person. It's not like they're reflecting. Like if I stand in it, I just have lasers all over me. But when a shadow figure pops into it, like you see an outline of them. And that was the first time I really saw that. And Meatloaf kept calling out to him, or Meat. He liked to be called Meat. But he kept calling out to this spirit. And it would get a little bit closer. It was getting a little more comfortable. And I swear, it felt like an hour or two we sat there because Meat did not want to leave. We were just like watching this shadow go back and forth. And yeah, it just seemed like someone kind of shy and like not sure of us. That was a really crazy experience.
Was that on the side next to the big machine or the side with the staircase going up?
I think it was the side with the big machine, if I remember correctly. So I mean, it's been a long time, so.
We had something similar. We didn't have the laser grid, but we were down there one night. I think it might have been our second or third time there. And we were on one end. I think we were on the staircase side where it just goes right back up into the main room up there. And it was real dark back towards the machine. And my cousin Sean pointed out first. He was like, I feel like there's something looking at us from behind that big machine.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked down that way, and sure enough, you could see something just kind of poking its head around the machine, looking at us. They go back over, come around the other side, peek at us. So I walked down that way. I get to the machine. You can actually squeeze past that machine, and the tunnel continues on for miles back that way.
Mm. Oh, I didn't know that.
And sure enough, there was nothing back there. But when I came back out, met back up with them, I looked back, and you could see it again. This thing just... It was like it was watching us, just studying us, you know?
Yeah, I felt like when we tried to get closer, it would kind of back off. And so we just kept our distance. And I swear, I think Meat even thought he knew his name. Like, he really felt as though he was a conduit for the paranormal and that he had, like, that he was psychic. And he was calling out to him. Gosh, I can't remember what it was. But side note, later on, so he had a really good time investigating with Adam and me. And so at the end of the night there, it was like 3:30 in the morning, and we're doing one last run way back, like by the boiler room or something. And our producer told us, he's like, don't tell Meatloaf that you're still investigating. He's like, we need to start wrapping up. And so don't tell him. And we're like, okay. And so we're sneaking to the boiler room so he wouldn't know. And we are doing an EVP session. All of a sudden, the producer comes around the corner and he's like, Meatloaf found out where you are. He thinks he's being funny. He's going to come scare you right now. So like, And so he comes barreling around the corner. He doesn't even have a camera operator with him. And he's just like, boo, Amy and Adam. And then so we literally had to sit there and investigate with him until the sun was coming up. The crew went into overtime. He was just so it was the funniest thing. So, yeah, fun stories. But now, over the time that you investigated there, what would you say was like your most frightening experience?
Definitely the most frightening. I think it was our fifth or sixth time there. We decided we were going to start doing, you know, kind of isolation sessions around the plant. So I decided, oddly enough, I was going to go down to the boiler room. So I make my way down there, and this is way back when I had that brick Nokia phone. You know, we didn't have the cell phones with the lights on them or anything. So I was like, I'm going to leave my phone with you guys because it creates this interference on the camera. So leave that behind. The only light I had was on my camera itself. So I make my way down into the boiler room and I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. I keep hearing things, you know, kind of off in the distance. I'm thinking maybe it's just the guys walking around messing with me or something. Well, I pull up my audio recorder, start recording. So, you know, if anybody's here, give me a sign. And all of a sudden it just felt so different in there. Like this heaviness just set in. Well, all of a sudden, my audio recorder just dies on me. And I'm like, okay, that's strange. Well, next thing I know, my camera dies on me. So I'm down there in pitch black. I can't see anything at all. And all of a sudden, something slaps me full force across the face.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sitting there in the dark, something slapping me, and I'm just like, well, this is it. I've had a good run, I guess. So the only thing I can think to say is, you know, I'm sorry. And I start feeling my way out of the boiler room. I had to work my way up the staircase. And when I reach the top of the staircase, I go and I find the other guys. And before I can even tell them, I got slapped in the face. So like, you know, what happened to you? What happened to your face? I had a handprint across my face and they took some pictures of it. But what was strange about it was if you go to touch it, you know, especially when you get slapped for it to be kind of warm. When they went to touch it, it was actually ice cold. And the only thing I can relate that to would be, you know, a foreman coming in, seeing me sitting there doing nothing and being like, hey, get back to work. Pow.
Yeah. Or just like, we don't want you here.
Yeah,
you know, that's, I mean, so those are the kind of experiences when people say, is investigating dangerous? Overall, no. Even getting slapped by a ghost, which I've been shoved, pushed, whatever, scratched. It's the reaction that you have. Like, thankfully, you calmly were like, I'm sorry, and you left. But a lot of people would run in the dark, probably run into some sort of large metal object and injure them, fall down some stairs. Like, because it's your instinct when that happens is flight. Your body is like, nope, out. And then the other lesson there, Kevin, is you always have a backup light. Always.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
I've learned that lesson too. That happened to us. This is somewhere else. We were at a mine of all places, and the power went out when we were under the ground. And I was like, oh my God, worst nightmare. And I just had my phone light, and I was like, God, what happens if this doesn't work?
That's true.
Well, that, I mean, that honestly, though, that is scary. And that is a message, you know? So it's really interesting. Now, what would you say is like maybe this kind of the most common activity that people experience there?
Definitely, you know, walking into a room, just feeling those unseen eyes on you and walking into cold spots. I took my cousin there. She wanted to do a report for school about my report for school. And, you know, I took her there. She'd never been there before. And as soon as I walked into a room, I felt the hairs on my arm starting to stand up. And before I could say anything, she was like, man, I'm cold. My hair on my arm is standing up. And just hearing footsteps, a lot of footsteps, sounds of people still working. That was one of the main things we've caught back in the day was sound like somebody hammering something or, you know, something along those lines. But
yeah, I feel like there's a lot of residual energy there, just in general. You can definitely feel that. And you're right. And I think that's one of the things with investigating is to kind of listen to your body, you know, what you're feeling, because that's usually a clue that something could potentially be about to go down. Like if you, you know, you start having that kind of like hair on the back of your neck standing up or like feeling of being watched, Like, there's a reason why we feel that way. That's instinct. And I definitely experienced that there. So now, is there a place there that you find, obviously the boiler room is high up, but is there, are there certain areas that you would consider hot spots for people who are investigating?
I would definitely say the boiler room and definitely the tunnel. I feel like we got the most activity there. And there used to be a boardwalk heading towards the tunnel. I think they've cemented that in now to kind of make it more of a regular, like, sidewalk type deal. But we'd hear all kind of stuff there. That first night we went, it was middle of summer, crickets chirping like crazy. And that guy that went with us that we didn't really know, he decided to start kind of provoking. And for me, I've never really wanted to try provoking. It's not really my thing, you know. But he starts just calling it out. He's, come on, show yourself. We're not scared of you. Do something. Do something. And all of a sudden, just every single sound around us just disappeared. Like, the crickets stopped. He couldn't hear any cars or anything. And this cold gust of wind blew in. And I remember looking at my cousin Sean. I'm just like, well, we're in a horror movie situation now. I think right after that, we were walking along, and I've got some video of this up on my YouTube channel. We're walking along, and I'm panning towards one of the roofs of the one of the buildings, and you see this figure standing on top of it. Well, as we get a little bit closer, this figure just kind of sinks into the building.
Wild.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, jump off or anything like that. It just kind of sinks into the building.
That's really, I do remember them mentioning that people see figures up on, like, the catwalks and stuff a lot, or, like, you know, walking in areas that you definitely do not have access to. And even that it's happened, like, during the day before too, where people are just there touring and they're like, who's that? And, you know, there's no live person in that area. So where were you when you had the experience where your friend started, like, trying to provoke? Was that outside?
Yes, that was outside on the boardwalk there.
Oh, that's right. You did mention that. So, because I had a really strange experience outside. I cannot remember if this was on camera or not. You know, it kind of all melds together. But I was walking kind of by where you go into the tunnel. And it was like a gravel kind of roadway. And I was walking, you know, step, crunch, crunch, crunch. And I heard steps behind me. And I thought it was someone trying to scare me, like on the crew or something. And I was like, I stopped and turned around and there's no one. And I'm like, okay. So I start walking and I hear it again, crunch, crunch, crunch. And I'm like, okay. And I stopped that time and it kept getting closer to me. And I was just like, okay, I'm just going to walk really fast. I probably started whistling. I've mentioned this before, but I have this theory that if you're whistling, nothing bad can happen to you. And so
I approve.
Yeah. And so I do remember that. And it was outside. So, I mean, obviously, haunts don't just stay indoors. But it was that was a pretty wild experience.
Definitely.
Okay, so we have hot spots. Now, so you said you've investigated there 7+ times. Does it seem like you've ever encountered, like, the same spirit more than once?
I would say so. That figure I was telling you about down in the tunnel that would kind of peek around the corner and watch us. I feel like we've seen it 2 to 3 more times just around the facility itself. One of those, we're actually kind of in the same place you were just talking about. And there's, like, these little inlets that go in between, like, some of the boilers there. Well, we were walking along, and I happened to look towards one of them, and same deal. I see this thing kind of standing there, peeking around the corner, watching us go over there, and it's nothing. So I feel like maybe there's at least one spirit there that's kind of like, man, let me see what's going on here. You know,
right.
Count us out or something.
Yeah. Now, what is your overall vibe there? Do you feel like these spirits are intelligent and interactive, or do you think that it's mostly residual type activity?
Weirdly enough, I feel like there's sort of a mixture of both. I feel like the majority is definitely residual, just from the sounds and, you know, people working, all that stuff, people seeing people up on the furnaces, you know, quote unquote working. But then you get those that, like I said, they'll be watching you. Or when I got slapped, that's definitely someone intelligent. So I feel like it's a good mixture of both.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm really hoping we can get back in there in an investigative fashion soon enough. But yeah, no, I find it super interesting. I'm glad you got to investigate it so many times. It was one of my favorite places to investigate. So it's fun to kind of revisit it. Now, you mentioned you have a YouTube channel. Do you want to tell people where they can find that and see some of your work?
Sure. It's on YouTube. The channel's called Alabama's Most Haunted. And basically, we go out to some of the most haunted places in Alabama. Once we get permission, of course, always remember that. Yeah, it's just Alabama's Most Haunted. I think we've got about 9 full-length episodes up now. And, you know, we got a couple of little previews, trailers, behind-the-scenes stuff. But there's a lot of haunted places in Alabama that people just don't know about. You got Sloss, which is famous for its hauntings. But there's also so many other places that are just kind of under the radar.
Yeah.
And kind of touching back on what you said when we first started, you know, with Sloss not really wanting that kind of publicity anymore, you know, there's several places we'll contact for the show and they're like, I'm sorry, we don't want to be affiliated with that kind of thing. We don't want that kind of image.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it comes from a place of misunderstanding. I think that there have been so many instances of people going in and kind of disrespectfully handling a haunt. And I think that at that point, you know, and I can't blame them. A lot of these historical locations are just like, we don't even want to deal with this. Like this is, but I've worked with a lot of places kind of hand in hand and helped them and educated on like how to do these in a way where it's a win-win for everyone. And so, like I said before, if anyone's listening and you want to know how to do it, like just feel free to reach out to me. I love helping. And so if there's any of those places you're trying to reach out to and you want to send them my way, go for it. Because I think it's important. You know, it's not just important for what we do, but like, what about the ghosts? I think about that. What about the ghosts? You know, like I think about Sloss ghosts where everybody was there talking to them all the time and suddenly there's no one. They got used to the attention. And now they're like, hello. I know. Yeah. So, but anyways, I really thank you for taking the time. It's been fascinating. And, you know, hopefully our paths will cross in person soon.
It sounds great. I look forward to it.
While in many ways, Sloss Furnaces highlights a tragic part of our history, it also stands a reminder of how important it is we don't forget that history. Ghosts or not, it's a very compelling place to visit, and I highly recommend you do so if you ever find yourself near Birmingham. I feel lucky to have investigated there when I did, and I do so hope the ghosts have found a way to reach out to others since, because as we all know, even if you avoid acknowledging a haunting, that doesn't mean the ghosts go away. I'm Amy Bruni, and this was Haunted Road. My fall tour has been announced, and I am going to a lot of places. I have stops in California, Ohio, Colorado, Virginia, North Carolina, New York, Connecticut, and more. So please head to amybruni.com if you're interested in seeing me live. My Life with the Afterlife, True Tales of the Paranormal Tour is a great chance to talk all about the hauntings I've encountered over my 20-plus years of paranormal investigating. It's spooky and fun and perfect for fall, and I can't wait for you to see it. Many of the venues have a VIP meet and greet option too, which are filling up fast. So again, head to amybruni.com and click on the events and appearances page to get tickets today. Thank you, friends. Haunted Road is hosted and written by me, Amy Bruni, with additional research by Taylor Hagedorn and Cassandra Day Alba. This show is edited and produced by Rima El-Khayali with supervising producer Josh Thane and executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Haunted Road is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. Learn more about this show over at grimandmild.com. And for more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.